Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. As you know, we've been going through the vetoes of both Madison and Monroe. We just finished the last episode with James Monroe's veto of the Department of Defense. So what we're going to do is do a kind of a summary of what Monroe kind of just did, in not in contrast, what I'm trying to do. And let me actually explain something. Why is it that I'm going through these three vetoes, Madison, Monroe, and Andrew? All three presidents who were presented with bills to create a new power for the federal government to allow them to tax and start improving the highways and waterways of the United States. All three presidents recognized that that power was not enumerated, even though they were trying to make implications that with post roads, the necessary and proper, or actually in addition to the post roads, this concept of commerce, the Commerce Clause was used, the General Welfare Clause was used, and then the necessary proper to take care of all of these things. So in other words, Congress was trying to stitch together these associations and implications that because of this and because of this and because of this, we should be able to do this instead of going to the states to try to amend the Constitution. See, what had happened is as Monroe's presidency, or actually Jackson's presidency, Jefferson, started with the J. Jefferson's presidency caused the 12th Amendment. And at that point in time, they kind of realized, well, you know, this is a little bit of effort to get this Constitution amended. Can't we just do these easy things? As long as we can kind of stitch a good connection between some powers and these good ideas and this noble intent, surely we could aggrandize the federal government's role. And Madison was very clear that they couldn't do that. Monroe was very clear that they couldn't do that, and President Jackson. So the reason why I do this reading, and it's, forgive me, it's a struggle. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put these up on my domain, on my Reclaiming the Republic domain. And actually, if you notice at the very top right-hand side, or just underneath home and so forth, I have a link to constitutional articles. That is where you can get a PDF copy of the argument, the description of Republic Review, as well as the model, along with a lot of other constitutional articles. I am going to place these vetoes up there as well. Why? This is very, very important. You need to understand that you need to be able to read and hear the words for yourself. It's so easy, and they do this all the time. As a matter of fact, the Democrats want you, because they don't want you to know the truth. They want you to take their word for it. Oh, yeah, we can do this. It's in the Constitution. And then when you challenge them, well, show me very specifically where in the Constitution this power exists. Article 1, Section 8 is where you'll find the enumerated powers. Show it to me. And they can't do it. But as long as they can get away with wiggling it around, and that's why the news media, if they're covering something and they know that they need to cut, they will cut away from that so you don't hear or even understand the fact that they're doing something unconstitutional. That's why you'll always get the sound bites from them, like when Nancy, oh yeah, this is constitutional, or we're doing this for the Constitution. I'm here to tell you, friends, and this is one of the reasons why I tell people, you've got to read these founding documents. You've got to understand the fundamentals. if you don't understand these things, it's just like reading the scriptures. If you don't understand the fundamentals, like, you know, the Ten Commandments and the Golden Rule and forgiving, or you have the greater sin and those types of things, if you don't understand those fundamentals, that these things are sins, we're supposed to hate the sins. You know, so in other words, we don't be politically correct and go, yeah, you know, you can do whatever you want to do. No, it's one thing to call something a sin and say that is a sin. You shouldn't be doing that, you know, and we want to help you overcome that affliction, that problem, that addiction, whatever it is. So we're supposed to love the sinner, but we're not supposed to be loving the sin and saying, you know, love is love and people should be able to, everybody should be able to get married. No, that is the same thing as condoning or accepting the sin and actually making it no longer a sin. So the fact be told, and the reason I'm going through all of these things is so that you understand them, because trying to get people to read is very difficult, and trying to get people motivated to say, I have to understand these things. I'm here to tell you that it doesn't take a lot of reading to read some of these fundamental documents. By the time you're done with reading, and I will admit that the ratification debates are a little bit meaty, but that's one of the reasons why I give you the highlights. And if you go to my Mobius Strip press page, you will find extracts of the ratification debates that I think hit the ball out of the park, that clarify completely that the federal government is only got these enumerated powers. My favorite is probably Mr. Iredell. It's a little bit long, but he basically likens the Constitution to a power of attorney, a listed or specified power of attorney, not a general power of attorney. Most people get that because most people kind of understand a power of attorney. So again, do not take my word for it. I challenge everybody's word for it. And I think, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And so as far as I'm concerned, you should be challenging my word. And that's why if I read these things, then it's a little bit more difficult for you to actually challenge what the heck I'm saying and what I'm asserting. So with that, and this took me a good chunk of time to kind of explain why it is these three vetoes are so important, because we had three presidents that stood up and did their job, that actually took their oath seriously. Well, Jackson in this one facet, because Jackson was guilty of self-aggrandizing the office of the presidency by using the cash that he had available to him to pay out for the spoil systems, giving contracts and or jobs to other people to help pay them back for their good loyalty. And that's why Jackson was kind of a two-face. In some ways, he did good things on the Constitution, but he stretched boundaries and stepped over limitations rather quickly. I mean, he had no power to cause the Indians to go on a trail of tears. There was no reason why he did what he did other than the fact that, and this has happened by, as the people clamor and say, we need your help. You've got to do this thing. You've got to get rid of these Indians. Well, I'm telling you, friends, because he did that, he stepped on the Constitution and it put us on a path of literally abusing unconstitutionally. But most people said, oh, well, yeah, he can do that. I'm here to tell you no. I'm here to tell you that these treaties, and I've talked about this before, these treaties that have created almost every single Indian reservation throughout the state, especially in the western states, every single one of those treaties is unconstitutional. I challenge you to come up with all of the treaties that created Indian reservations that were actually constitutionally ratified by Congress. Now, I will tell you that in the beginning, there was a constitutionally ratified constitutionally ratified treaty with some Indians in displacing them to the West. But it didn't create a reservation. It just basically says, we're going to kind of let you have this or what have you out there. And if you look, that was at the very, very, very beginning, but they stopped doing that. And what ended up happening was they actually created states and they violated that. And so obviously the treaty is null and void. What do you do when a treaty is being violated? It's null and void. When you actually pass a law or you do something that is in a direct violation of that treaty, because the treaty becomes the law of the land. This is what we're supposed to do. So when the government violates that, then it nullifies that absolute treaty. And at that point in time, those few tribes or Native Americans, Indians, what have you, they had a right to have a war and go after and do whatever they felt necessary to, you know, punish those who had violated. But what do you do when the person or the entity has all that power to actually, you know, be able to, you know, not only take, but actually dish out worse than what you can give them in violating those treaties? And so this is a part of what Republic Review will do. It will actually clarify where that land is, what should happen, and what we need to do to move forward, because we don't need treaties with Indians. The intent should have never been maintaining independent sovereignty, because creating independent sovereignty within a state is a violation of the state. You cannot have two separate sovereigns of the same land. And even though you got to understand, a state is a state. It's a boundary. All the land belongs to it. But with that, we will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their Constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in, and let's get on with the dialogue. And I don't necessarily like to just meander on a intro and my kind of opening monologue, but I thought maybe it was necessary to try to explain why I'm going through these. And what we're going to be doing after we go through these three Department of Transportation vetoes by Madison, Monroe and now Jackson, because we're going to dive into Jackson after I kind of really quickly summarize how Monroe kind of dispatched with, and I think he hit it out of the park. He did an excellent job, just like Madison. And so, you know, we're going to have a lot more to digest with Jackson. But what we're going to do is we're going to cover the cod fisheries bounties regarding the General Welfare Clause. And the reason why this clause, and or I should say not clause, but this document or this lecture, this testimony that James Madison is giving, it is on the floor of Congress as he is explaining to Congress the limitations of the General Welfare Clause. They should have, because see, here's the problem. When you're dealing with laws and when you're dealing with the understanding and the definitions of those laws, if all of a sudden everybody realizes that they're out of scope in understanding that, they need to, they did document all this, but they need to highlight in that documentation, here is a definition of the General Welfare Clause. But what Congress did was they put it aside so that they could ignore it later and use the General Welfare Clause to benefit them in self-aggrandizing their roles, responsibilities, and powers. And they did that all unconstitutionally. But this testimony by James Madison is official testimony. He is explaining, and it is acknowledged, that nobody understood the Constitution better than James Madison. And I will tell you, he may have made minor violations. They all did. But he was the most noble. He was the most honorable. He honored the Constitution with such integrity that to me, he is our greatest president we've ever had. Washington was a great leader, and he, you know, won the war, so to speak. But he didn't really win the war because Britain just basically used that treaty. And that's one of the reasons why it came to Madison's feet again. And Madison had to end that war. And it almost looked like it was going to be another stalemate until this guy called Andrew Jackson came forward and unleashed a little butt-whooping on Britain down in Louisiana and kind of convinced Britain that they just don't and they never will have what it's going to take to make these, what their former colonies were, to subjugate them. And so, and here's another little note about Andrew Jackson. This guy was, I'll just say he was a quasi-loose cannon. He was one of those guys that was not very respectful. When Washington retired, everybody, when he went into the halls of Congress to actually, you know, announce his retirement or to step down, and it was the formal ceremony. Back then, they didn't have these outdoor huge inaugurations. It was just in front of Congress. So when he was stepping down and they were inaugurating President Adams, and you'd probably heard the common thing he says, well, I am fairly out and you are fairly in. Good luck with you, and I'll be happy being out of this. anyway, long story short, when Washington walked into the chambers of Congress, everybody took off their hat except for one person, and that one person was Andrew Jackson. Apparently, he had no respect for the office of the president when he walked in that room. And so that kind of speaks to the character of the individual, because even as a military man, because he was in the military, even as a military man, you still render respect to the office. And Jackson had no respect for Washington or no respect for the office. And therefore, it kind of speaks, I want to share these little tidbits when I know them about these individuals to kind of help you understand their paradigm, how these guys think and how they operate. And so that is one of the reasons why I will tell you that President Jackson was a tyrant because he thought he was above and beyond these things that, you know, were limiting everybody else, but not necessarily him. And so back to Monroe. And actually, before I get into Monroe, the one thing I do want to remind you is that we do have a dial-in number. I want to kind of get through this, and I don't want to waste much more of your time because we're heading into, you know, a pause between this episode and the next. So hopefully we can, you know, cover as much ground as possible. So the listen number is 605-562-4209. And, oh, by the way, I can't forget the sponsorships. We do have Red State Coffee. Please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org, click on that link, and please support our sponsors, especially if you drink coffee and you're looking for a good premium coffee. This is a great premium coffee. Tell us what you think. Just call 425-270-5416 and let us know what you think. And let me dive into those six powers, I believe, that Monroe identified, or actually Congress tried to identify that they had these powers to grant them this ability to create the Department of Transportation. Now, remember, keep in mind, we're talking about the Department of Transportation and how they kind of justify this. And Monroe says, according to my, and I'm going to read this, but I want to highlight this. First, from the right to establish post offices and post roads. Second, because let me read the paragraph before this. It has never been contended that the power was specifically granted. It is claimed only as being incidental to some one or more of the powers which are specifically granted. The following are the powers from which it is said to be derived. So these are the powers that Congress is saying, we got these powers, let us create the Department of Transportation. First, from the right to establish post offices and post roads. We can build these post roads. And you understand a post road is a road that connects the state capital to the Washington, D.C., so that people have access to Washington, D.C. So it's the federal government's job to make sure that you have a good highway from your state. And what they've done is they've created this network of interstates to connect all the states in the West to lead them to the East, to Washington, D.C. That's why we have the highway system that we have. Now, a lot of the interstates are unconstitutional because they had no intent of actually connecting, nor were they leading from one state capital to another. Now, if you look at Sacramento, that leads over to Salt Lake, that leads over to Denver, so forth, but these aren't really, they started meandering and just creating a broader network, but not a direct network from one capital to the next, to the next, to the next, if you understand what I'm saying. What they did was they just created, because they felt they had this ability, because the Department of Transportation was just an assumed role, and they started making all these different roads, north, south, east, and west. Anyway, so moving on, they did not have this power on the post roads. They only had the very specific power from post roads. Second, from the right to declare war, the right to declare war gave them the right to create a highway system, canals, and so forth. Apparently, I think the thought was that because they could declare war, then they could create a road network so that they could move forces and so forth. Sorry. That's still not their responsibility. That you got to remember that the militia, not a standing army and so forth, it was up to the states to do what they needed to do to defend their state and move their militia from one state to the next. Third, to regulate commerce. And clearly he's pinging all of these things saying, no, you cannot use this to regulate commerce. This falls under that. Fourth, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare. So it was the general welfare part that they tried to say, we think because this supports the general welfare. From the power to make all laws necessary and pursuits, there's that sweeping clause that they called it in the Virginia ratification debates when it was absolutely Absolutely. Defined as it is written here, but they actually did not include Monroe did not include the language because this is what he says. From the power to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution all the powers vested in the Constitution. So what is that? That is not the necessary and proper clause that we have learned, and I would say have loved to understand, because when you read Article 1, Section 8, and you read the necessary and proper clause, it says, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, before it closes that clause. And he did not include the foregoing powers. So he did not really explain, and I think he could have explained it better, but he didn't. And then sixth and lastly, the power to dispose of and make all needful rules, regulations respecting the territory and other property of the United States. No. And that was such a broad reach, because the whole point was in the territories is if it's a territory, it needs to be worked into a state. Anyway, they have the responsibility of setting the parameters for those states to step up. But we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so Monroe closes after he's listed these six things that Congress has used to justify the usurpation of the state's roles, responsibilities, and powers. Monroe states this, according to my judgment, it cannot be derived from either of those powers, nor from all of them united, and in consequence, this power, in other words, does not exist. Having stated my objections to the bill, I now cheerfully communicate at large the reasons on which they are founded, and so forth and so on. He goes on to say, you know, if you want to do this, you've got to amend the Constitution, and let's have a conversation about that in the next point in time with the sessions of Congress and so forth. Bottom line, here Monroe clearly told Congress that they did not have this power at all within the Constitution, that if they wanted to exercise this power, they need to amend the Constitution. Again, that was back in 1822.
in May of 1822. Again, in May of 1830, President Jackson now vetoes a bill. Now, you got to understand, Monroe was already in his fourth term, right? So when he stepped down, because he took office in 1817, he was reelected in 1816. So that would have taken him to 2024, or not 2024, I'm sorry. That's hopefully when Trump will go to, but that would have taken him to 1824. And then John Quincy Adams went from 2024 to 2028, and that is in 2029 when Jackson became president. So in May 1830, Jackson vetoes Congress's attempt. So in other words, and I'm pointing this out because I pointed out before, Monroe was considered a dead or lame duck type of president because he was in his last term, or actually he was in a position where he could do whatever he wanted and not have to worry about too many consequences because he's not looking for election. And so they gave this to him in his second term, and he, because it was just expected that he was only going to do two terms because that's how all the presidents did it. Now with Jackson, this was his first term. He took office in 2029 and this was his second year of operating, and Congress, knowing that he was a huge spender, and as a matter of fact, at this point in time, Jackson was already guilty of creating jobs because there was a downturn in the economy and justifying it because what ended up happening, if you read my first book, I talk about this, and I'm not trying to, you know, poke it, but I point out that the first time the clergy, the religious leaders in America, went to the White House for, saying, hey, you got to help us out, was in 1830. It was with Jackson's administration where they were actually putting their hand out saying, government's got to help us. And I argue this point that it was in the 1820s and 1830s when there was a shift in Christianity in America. This was the birth of the evangelical movement. And I've talked about this, and I want to cover this real quick, why this is important. Because Jackson was the one that actually started creating federal jobs or temporary jobs to help employ people, to give them some money, so to give relief to the professional clergy out there. So what was happening is that the evangelical troops would go through the states, these different states at different times and so forth, and they would pocket the money, and then the churches that would be left behind, they weren't getting the contributions, all the contributions from the people, because the people that got the money left town. So when all of a sudden there was a downturn in the economy, this is when it happened. So the evangelical troops were already traveling around, and people were kind of paying these guys for, you know, entertaining them with miracles or what have you. And so it was the birth of the evangelical movement that drove these professional pastors and so forth, who were working for money, because that's how they were putting a roof over their head. They became a professional pastor, because before that, you know, it was a layman's church where, you know, people would contribute and they would help, and they actually had a normal job. The reason they had a roof over their head was because they actually worked for a living, and then they did the Lord's work in their spare time. Well, the evangelical movement was bringing in the professional clergy and basically modeling all these new Christian faiths, just like the Catholic Church, where they became professional full-time priests. They dedicated their whole life to the service, which, if you understand the whole reason they fell away from that, was to say, that's not right. This is not a professional job. I mean, even the apostles had jobs. They were fishermen and so forth, and they had to take care of their families. And so that's why they would be found going home and taking care of their families. Anyway, I digress. I've taken way too much time on this. The whole point is that Jackson, he had the moral compass to stop this actual bill, but he actually used his position to create jobs. So I think that that's one of the reasons why Congress felt, oh, well, we should be able to go in there and do this and help him aggrandize even more jobs. Anyway, so this is what he says. Gentlemen, I have maturely considered the bill proposing to authorize, quote, a subscription of stock in the Maysville, Washington, Paris, and Lexington Turnpike Road Company, and now return the same to the House of Representatives in which it originated with my objections to its passage. So in other words, they were going to nationalize this roadway or this road building service company or what have you, because they called it the Turnpike Road Company. Sincerely, friendly to the improvement of our country by means of roads and canals, I regret that any difference of opinion in the mode of contributing to it should exist between us. And if in stating this difference I go beyond what the occasion may be deemed to call for, I hope to find an apology in the great importance of the subject, an unfeigned respect for the high source from which this branch of its emanated, and an anxious wish to correctly understood, which correctly, reading this, sometimes the language or the English, the way they speak is a little bit difficult. So what he said was, which from this branch of it has emanated, and an anxious wish to be correctly understood by my constituents in the discharge of all my duties. Diversity, oh, there's that word already is popping out. Diversity of sentiment among public functionaries actuated by the same general motives on the character and tendency of particular measures is an incident common to all governments, and the more to be expected in which one, like ours, owes its existence to the freedom of opinion and must be upheld by the same influence. Controlled as we thus are by a higher tribunal before which our respective acts will be canvassed with the indulgence due to the imperfections of our nature, and with that intelligence and unbiased judgment, we are the true correctives of error. All that our responsibility demands is that the public good should be the measure of our views, dictating alike their frank expression and honest maintenance. So this is the first paragraph, and he really hasn't gotten into anything. This is just all a lot of platitudes, if you understand what I'm saying. He really hasn't hit anything other than he's saying, well, I kind of owe it to everybody that, you know, I give this response with some apologies, but hopefully I don't step on anybody's feelings. And I'm going, really? Are you kidding me? Anyway, going on. In the message which was presented to Congress at the opening of its present session, I endeavored to exhibit briefly my views upon the importance and highly interesting subject to which our attention is now to be directed. I was desirous of presenting to the representatives of the several states in Congress assembled the inquiring whether some mode could not be devised which would reconcile the diversity of opinion concerning the powers of this government over the subject of internal improvement, and the manner in which these powers, if conferred by the Constitution, ought to be exercised. The act which I am called upon to consider has, therefore, been passed with a knowledge of my views on this question, as they are expressed in the message referred to. In that document, the following suggestions will be found. Excuse me. After the extinction of the public debt, it is not probable, that any adjustment to the tariff upon principles satisfactory to the people of the Union, because I got to stop here. You have to give Jackson credit because Jackson's focus was trying to pay the public debt and keep the debt down. Anyway, moving on, satisfactory to the people of the Union will, and we're heading into a break, I'm sorry. So we'll start this paragraph off. as we go into our last segment, and then we'll try to find a good spot to where we can kind of conclude this discussion and pick this up in our next episode. So we will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Folks, Red State Talk Radio has brought back its monthly newsletter. I know everyone gets a lot of emails, but this is not a daily or weekly newsletter. It's a monthly newsletter. So you will not be overwhelmed with a plethora of emails from Red State Talk Radio. Come on, it's only once a month. I'll be contributing a constitutional perspective to one of the current issues to help everyone see an alternative perspective, or what I believe would be a framer's perspective regarding the issue to help us maintain a constitutional paradigm. I will also provide information regarding a significant historical context to the time of year so that we can remember our history, so we will not be doomed to repeat the inevitable failings from forgetting our past and origins. Just go to Red State Talk Radio and sign up for the newsletter. This way you can get a focused view of what is going on in the Republic as well as what is going on at Red State Talk Radio. Thank you. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Okay, so let me start from the top of this paragraph. After the extinction of the public debt, it is not probable that any adjustment of the tariff upon principles satisfactory to the people of the Union will, until a remote period, if ever, leave the government without a considerable surplus in the Treasury beyond what it may be required for its current service. As then the period approaches when the application of the revenue to the payment of the debt will cease, the disposition of the surplus will present a subject for the serious deliberation of Congress, and it may be fortunate for the country that it has yet to be decided. Considered in the conjunction with the difficulties which we have heretofore attended appropriations for the purpose of internal improvements, and with those which this experience tells us will certainly arise whenever power over such subjects may be exercised by the general government, it is hoped that it may lead to the adoption of some plan which reconciled the diversified interests of the states and strengthened the bonds which unite them. Every member of the Union, in peace and in war, will be benefited by the improvement of land navigation and the construction of highways in the several states. Let us then endeavor to attain this benefit in a mode which will be satisfactory to all, that hitherto adopted has by many of our fellow citizens been deprecated as an infraction of the Constitution, while by others it has been viewed as inexpedient. All feel that it has been employed at the expense of harmony in the legislative councils. And adverting to the constitutional power of Congress to make what I consider a proper disposition of the surplus revenue, I subjoin the following remarks. To avoid these evils, it appears to me that the most safe, just, and federal disposition which could be made of the surplus revenue would be its apportionment among the several states according to their ratio of representation. And should this measure not be found warranted by the Constitution, that it would be expedient to propose to the states an amendment authorizing it. So what he's talking about is that now, and you got to remember that it's not like they expunged the debt in his 1 year. I believe that the planning and all of this came forth from John Quincy Adams and so forth, because they were no longer fighting the wars. They had had peace since James Madison, Monroe, you know, and John Quincy Adams were clearly the recipients of a long perpetual peace and so forth. But trying to pay off the debt, it looked like after the first year of Jackson's presidency, they had reached that point, or was going to be reaching that point soon. They go, well, what are we going to do with the surplus from all these tariffs as we, you know, basically expire the tariff? And he's saying, well, maybe we should give it back to the states. But if it's found not warranted by the Constitution, then maybe we should amend the Constitution and authorize the federal government to pay the states based on their representation. Now, I'm pointing this out because if you understand what happened under Bush at the very end of W's presidency, he paid a bunch of trillions of dollars to the state of New York for the banking and the fiascos that occurred under these insurance companies and real estate and so forth. Remember the TARP funds? That was not warranted because they never amended the Constitution for the federal government to be able to bail out any type of corporation or entity, whether it be a state or not. Because here, even Jackson's pointing out that they cannot just give money out to the states or to any type of entity unless the Constitution is amended. The constitutional power of the federal government to construct or promote works of internal improvement presents itself in two points of view. The first is bearing unto the sovereignty of the states within those within whose limits their execution is contemplated. If jurisdiction of the territory which they may occupy be claimed as necessary to their preservation and use, the second as asserting the simple right to the appropriate money from the national treasury in aid of such works when undertaken by state authorities, surrendering the claim of jurisdiction. Now, I want to be clear here. He's talking about the states actually surrendering their claim of jurisdiction. They can't. They cannot surrender their claim of jurisdiction to the federal government. You've got to remember that the federal government's jurisdiction is limited to the objects enumerated within the Constitution. It's not whether the states can surrender. They have to amend the Constitution for the federal government to constitutionally assume or receive any new power. It's not, the states just can't let it go and let the federal government do that. Even if they are doing that and the federal government is assuming the power, they are assuming and exercising unconstitutional power because Article 5 is the process for them to assume the power. So moving on, he says, in the first view, the question of power is an open one, but it's really not, because Jackson did not understand the Constitution and can be decided without the embarrassments attending the other arising from the practice of the government. Although frequently and strenuously attempted, the power to this extent has never been exercised by the government in a single instance. It does not, in my opinion, possess it, and no bill, therefore, which admits it can receive my official sanction. But in the other view of the power, the question is differently situated. The ground taken at an earlier period of the government was that whenever money has been raised by the general authority and is to be applied to a particular measure, a question arises whether the particular measure be within the enumerated authorities vested in Congress. If it be, the money requisite for it may be applied to it. If not, no such application can be made. The document in which this principle was first advanced is of deservedly high authority and should be held in a grateful remembrance for its immediate agency in rescuing the country from much existing abuse and from its conservative effect upon some of the most valuable principles of the Constitution. The symmetry and purity of the government would doubtless have been better preserved if this restriction of the power of appropriation could have been maintained without weakening its ability to fulfill the general objects of its institution, an effect so likely to attend its admission notwithstanding its apparent fitness, that every subsequent administration of the government embracing a period of 30 of the 42 years of existence has adopted a more enlarged construction of the power. In other words, they have just self-aggrandized. It is not my purpose to detain you by a minute recital of the acts which sustain this assertion, but it is proper that I should notice some of the most prominent in order that the reflections which they suggest to my mind may be better understood. Now, I got to point out here, I've only got a couple minutes left, so this next one is a very long paragraph. So what we're going to end up doing is I'm going to cut it off right there, because this is where he's going to be getting into millions of dollars for the purchase of the Louisiana Purchase and so forth and so on. And I'm going to analyze, because what Jackson is trying to do is he's actually laying out some concepts here. He basically mentioned that they have set precedents. I want you to understand there is nowhere in the Constitution nor in the ratification debates that precedence is a path of creating and making something constitutional. Just because they've been doing it, just because the states have allowed it to happen, does not change the fact that it is a violation to the Constitution. Oh, well, we did this, and then we did this, and now we've done it three times, so now we've got precedence. No, and you got to understand, Jackson's also a lawyer. And so this whole concept of common law and precedence and case law was becoming embraced more and more. So they've basically started saying, well, let's create precedence, and that's how we can change the Constitution. And so that the court, along with Congress, along with the President of the United States, now being Andrew Jackson, started working together in moving and allowing the federal government to help itself self-aggrandize. Nowhere, and I'm going to just emphasize this, nowhere will you find any allowance within the Constitution or any mention during the ratification debates that allowed them to use precedents, case law, and so forth. The only process for the federal government to constitutionally assume any new role, responsibility, and power was through the amendment process. And actually, George Jefferson was very clear on this, that the only way they could actually do anything was through the amendment process when he was leaving. Not George Jefferson, George Washington. My apologies. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. We'll be back in the next episode with more of this. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.